Good afternoon. This is Saturday, March 15th, 2003, and you are listening to The LaRouche Show, the weekly audio webcast of the LaRouche Movement. I'm Michelle Steinberg, counterintelligence co-editor of Executive Intelligence Review magazine. We are privileged to have some very special guests today to discuss the fight against the police state measures in the United States, the violations of constitutional law being carried out by Attorney General John Ashcroft, a notorious individual, as will be explained to you by one of our guests, Edward Spanis, the legal editor of EIR. And I'm honored to present our other guest, Dr. Najib bin Mohammed al-Nawimi, the former Justice Minister of Qatar, and currently the head and driving force behind the Committee for the Defense of the Detainees and POWs in Guantanamo, the infamous Camp X-Ray American Gulag. Dr. Najib, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Before we begin, I want to start with giving everybody a brief picture of the incredible battle that we have had in the United States in collaboration with forces internationally to jam up and to prevent our government, the Bush administration, from launching an unjust, uncalled for, unnecessary imperial war in Iraq. Beginning on Monday, the LaRouche movement began to circulate a mass leaflet called What Secretary Colin Powell Did Not Say. This statement from Lyndon LaRouche's presidential campaign identified that the week between March 10th and March 16th, tomorrow, was a critical one for war or peace. During that time, the American administration tried to bully and ram through a resolution in the Security Council. You might have heard that the United States had all of the votes necessary to pass a second resolution for war. That was propaganda. They did not have the votes. In fact, the entire world population, the majority of that world population, is saying no to war. The Parliament of Turkey voted against basing rights for U.S. soldiers. On and on, the continent of Africa governments have signed on that there must be a peaceful solution. Inside the United States, the leading statesman, and unfortunately until now, the only presidential candidate in a major party to oppose without equivocation this war against Iraq has been Lyndon LaRouche. Now, to silence people, there's a massive campaign of intimidation inside the United States by the press, by the infamous neoconservative chicken hawks. People who like to plan mass genocide have never put on a uniform themselves. Our goal is to break their hold on the American politicians and on the American political parties and see a United States which is free of these chicken hawks. Now, we have another objective. The war will be used as a cover to ram through one of the biggest assaults on American constitutional and civil rights, not to mention human rights, that has ever occurred in the history of our nation. Here to talk to us today on the LaRouche Show is Ed Spanis. Go ahead.
Thank you, Michelle. We are still very determined, and many people are, to stop this war that the chicken hawks are pushing. But if that war goes ahead, we can expect a couple of things to happen almost immediately, apart from the fact that the dollar is going to crash and you're going to have a big capital flight out of the U.S. economy. Ashcroft will probably repeat the dragnet and the roundups of Arabs and Muslims in the United States, with a special emphasis on Iraqi immigrants. They have already put out, the government has already put out a list of something like 300 Iraqis around the world in various countries, in which they've ordered other countries to also arrest and deport. And then the so-called Patriot II Act, the sequel to the USA Patriot Anti-Terrorism Act, so-called Anti-Terrorism Act, that was passed shortly after 9/11. This has been drafted and is ready to go. And the indications are that as soon as a war starts, they will use the pretext of that to ram this thing through, which is far more sweeping and draconian, if that's possible, than the first Patriot Act. And I can go through some of the details of what is involved in that. But it will involve for more detentions, more secrecy, more denial of due process, more surveillance and investigations of people. It even allows for a U.S. citizen to be stripped of his citizenship and deported without due process. It allows other deportations to go on in secret. It allows the U.S. government to deport people at the request of a foreign government that presently is governed by treaties. You cannot extradite somebody to another country unless there's a treaty that specifies what crimes are involved. Under this, any country, let's say Israel, could say, we want you to extradite so-and-so, and you do it without due process, without a treaty. So this is what is now drafted. It's completely ready to go. It's on the books.
Has it been introduced already?
No. In fact, it was leaked to a watchdog group, the Center for Public Integrity, in Washington about 3-4 weeks ago. Only days before that, Senator Leahy, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, had inquired of the Justice Department if, in fact, they were drafting and drawing up a sequel to the USA Patriot Act. They denied it, and then this thing was leaked. So when Attorney General Ashcroft appeared before the Judiciary Committee about a week ago, he was thoroughly grilled on that. And Leahy, I believe it was, accused him outright of just lying about the fact that this bill was drafted and in final form, really. I mean, I've looked at the thing, and this is not something that was just thrown together overnight. This took months and months of preparation.
Well, I'd like to immediately address another aspect of this, and that is the work that Dr. Najib has been doing. Dr. Najib, when you came here, among other things, you were seeking the ability to have contact, meet your clients who are detained in a gulag in Cuba. Can you tell us how they got there and what you have found since you've been here in the United States?
Yeah, I have, in fact, formed this committee on March last year. And the aim of the committee, in fact, tried to defend and to seek an access to meet with the detainees and make some kind of legal presentation for them and to follow up, you know, on behalf of their families, you know, their affairs, their way of living, being treated, and their location and whether they've been tortured or they've been not, or the way they are actually being taken as well. So what we did from the beginning, in fact, these detainees were really painted with one color, which is, you know, these groups are belongs to Al-Qaeda and belong to Taliban, and they are actually the enemy combat and being, you know, captured during the war. And this is not the truth. The truth, the painting of one color was wrong, because the majority of them are innocent. They were captured in the street of Pakistan, walking around or in a mosque or in a library or a shop, and they were actually detained and transferred by plane to Guantanamo. And you have seen them, really, the way they were treated on the plane. They were chained on the plane's floor, and their hands tight and their eyes closed, and that is, in fact, is a breach of the international law, anti-torture law, which is America has actually have assignee and ratified it. From that day too, we're actually corresponding to with the president, and then the president referred us to the defense, and we talked to the defense, and we were waiting, in fact, of, you know, two ways: either they have to be released or they have to be actually put on a trial. And in fact, after a long media campaign and a direct discussion, they realize that there are many of them are innocent and they have no link to any terrorist, whoever. They were just normal civilians being around within that area. They were the victim of the war themselves. They were the victims of the conflict between two parties. They were normal people. They're working on a charity basis or working on agriculture or working in education in Pakistan and some in Afghanistan. So they were themselves really a victim, and it took the massive defense really some time to investigate and find out that the sweater we have said from the beginning was true. And another thing that that some of them will be actually put on a trial, which is applying the law of setting up a commission, which is called, you know, the
the tribunal.
A tribunal, yeah, but this special tribunal, like military tribunal. A military tribunal, which means that a commission which will be set up by an appointment by the president and upon the recommendation of the defense, Secretary of Defense, and the prosecutor will be from the army, the defendants will be from the army, the hearings actually by the army, and the location will be Guantanamo Bay. It's not going to be the U.S., it's going to be in that island. We, in fact, legally speaking, oppose such a commission to be set up. This should be, you know, treated like any other civilian, because if you have to accuse them, if you would accuse them as a militia or a part of a certain army or a system at that time, Taliban, then you have to apply Geneva Convention, which set up the rules of treatment. And as well as to be released, should be released by the end of the war, or if you will treat them as a criminal, then you have to have your own criminal system, you know, to be applied. And let's say if they are a criminal or they committed a crime, so the whole of the circuit, as you can say, is not properly managed in accordance. If we compare it to international law.
Dr. Najib?
Yes.
We've been told that these people they're all terrorists. These are the most dangerous people in the world.
It's not true. It's not true, and it has been realized by the U.S. government. It's not true.
You think this is why?
They found that themselves after 1 year, 4 months, that it's not true. And let me tell you that the first two people released after 4 months of capture and interrogation, Guantanamo, were two people were actually mentally disabled. One was Afghani, one from Tajik. They were actually disabled because when the war broke in Afghanistan, these guys got out of hospital and started, you know, hanging on the street because everybody ran away. So they were captured. After 4 months, they found out that they were actually mentally disabled. I mean, then they were released. I mean, and the rest of the four which they were released, you know, a guy of over 97 years old, and they have nothing to do really with what is the law which was issued after September, you know, anti-terrorist, which is either they have to be a member or associated. They are not a member and they are not associated. They were just normal civilians, and even if they were sympathizers, you cannot classify it as a member.
How many of the prisoners in Guantanamo actually do you believe are Al-Qaeda or Taliban?
Well, the number are there, 625 to my knowledge, some sources say 650. To my understanding, they're around, who could be really in a clear commitment, are around 60, 70 person, nothing so more. This is the sources I got it from. From them, I mean, not from the defense, I mean from Afghanistan, and the rest are not really, they're just normal. Take for example a cameraman from Al Jazeera. He was there reporting officially to Al Jazeera, and he's there in Guantanamo. He didn't do anything. A Jordanian who was actually sentenced for 15 years ago, and he was released from Pakistan, released after September or 13th, 14th September, detained and taken to Guantanamo. I mean, this guy was 15 years in jail. I don't think so. He was a member. And a lot of stories of students who went there during the holidays, you know, July and August, they were actually captured at the time after September, because usually they go back home after 15th of September. But after 11th, all the borders were sealed, all the flights being stopped, everybody was checked if he's actually an Arab. And so they were actually in a trap. And some of them managed to get out, and some of them could not, and they are in Guantanamo, but they are not a member.
Under international law, or the Geneva Convention, which I believe the U.S. has signed, what should be happening with these people?
In fact, they are classified, from my point of view, that they are a civilian. I wouldn't classify them as a militia, or a fighter, or an army, or whatever. They were normal civilian. If I take that example, a cameraman was there, I wouldn't classify him as a fighter. Students were there, I wouldn't classify him as a fighter. I wouldn't classify them as a militia. Militia means that these guys, for example, been there for over a year, and they left their countries, and they are joining some kind of camps, and they were trained for 1 year, 2 years. They know what to do. They are very well aware of their destination and their purpose. But these are not. The one there are not. They were there for 3 months. I wouldn't, you know, make them in 3 months during their, what we call it, university vacation, school vacation, as really an army. So they are civilian. They have to be treated as a civilian. And they should be really, after interrogation, let's say, okay, they have the right of defense to interrogate because it is the security of the U.S., the security of a nation. Fine, but after the interrogation, if you have found out, or you found out that they have nothing to do with it, or they are little, and it was announced that they don't have information, that was said by the Ramsey themselves, there are so many are unuseful. I mean, just hang around there. So release them.
Are they supposed to have access to a lawyer under the Geneva Convention?
They are being given access to a lawyer. I am their lawyer. I was denied to even travel to Guantanamo, denied to meet with them. But I understand why they are saying that, why doing that. And if I will classify it under the international law, that is a breach of international law and a breach of the law. If I were to classify it on which comes first, security or human rights, then it comes security here rather than human rights, you know, elements, like, you know, presenting a defense on that. It's a mixture. But... I'm always saying that I think the U.S. government has to realize and should understand that these people are innocent, and there are a lot of innocent people now around the world being charged, like the students who were there just in the U.S., and many of them actually left their university here and went back home, and they decided not to go back because of the bad treatment. So it's not him. I mean, the system here just got crazy.
Dr. Najib,
very, very, very frustrated.
Yes, Dr. Najib, I'd like you to clarify, as we were discussing before the show, the confusion that many observers have, Americans, international people. Have these detainees been charged? And as I understand from you, they are not being prosecuted by the Justice Department or Ashcroft, but under the military. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yes. The situation, the legal situation as follows. The detainees really fall within the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Defense and not under the jurisdiction of Ashcroft system. They are being actually, in a way, outlawed of the normal civilian laws and constitution in the United States. They're being actually dealt with within two laws issued after September, the anti-terrorist law and the setup of the commission. They've been actually put outside the judicial system of the U.S., and it was approved through many cases being filed on behalf of the detainees in the U.S. court, and the U.S. courts, in fact, have decided in one element that saying we have no jurisdiction to adjudge and declare on the merits of the applications, because of the petition, so-called. Because they say they were detained outside the U.S. which is in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and really relocated outside the U.S., which is Guantanamo Bay, which the Cubans have the sovereignty, and the U.S. have the jurisdiction and the exercise of the power, military power over the island. So they are from the American judicial system that they are actually an aliens which do not fit with our legal system.
Right. I understand that the court said that they have no constitutional rights because the Constitution does not apply
yes.
in Guantanamo because this is Cuban sovereignty. But,
yes.
But didn't you try and go to the court in Cuba also?
I tried to go to Cuba courts, and I met with the diplomats there, and they refused to allow me to file an application or a petition against the U.S. or against the Cuban government. And their answer saying, you know, we have enough problems with the U.S. government, and we don't need more.
So they don't claim.
It was not really a legal answer. It was a political
right.
answer.
A political answer, absolutely.
So this is the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights,
yes.
Sergio Vieira de Mello, said this week, he said, I can't accept that there's a legal black hole in Guantanamo. He said, how can we conceive that on this planet there exist areas of land where no law applies? Is that accurate, that there's no law that applies to this area?
No, there are laws applied to this area. There are so many things. It is in the hand of the Arab government or in the hands of the government who the Chinese belong to. Because under the international law, any state who has one detainee inside Guantanamo can file an application before the International Court of Justice in The Hague, in Holland, and request the U.S. to release them on the basis of, you know, breach of international humanitarian law. Let's take one example. The Mexicans have filed an application in the International Court of Justice requesting to stop the execution of, I think, 3 or 6 Mexicans. And the International Court of Justice have made an order requesting the U.S. government to stop, not to carry on the execution. And the U.S. have obeyed that. There are ways of really approaching through international law. But unfortunately, these nationals and their governments are a corrupted governments, a government which is really a dictatorship where there is no democracy. They obey and they follow whatever the U.S. government says because they're scared on their seats not to be thrown out. They are actually following in the path of, you know, stay away from crisis, and you can be as long, you know, as they could ruling families or ruling presidents in our world. So these governments are corrupted. There are ways and means to get out of that. But unfortunately, nobody is exercising these rights under international law.
Can you tell us, Dr. Najib, about the committee itself? Who else is on it? What is it doing?
The committee is really an ad hoc committee. It contains of different lawyers from worldwide, members of that, Ramsey Clark from the U.S., for example, and from Kuwait, and from Saudi Arabia, from Jordan, from Egypt, from Yemen, and from Denmark, and Sweden. Their aim, in fact, is really to keep in touch with the families of the detainees and feed them back information and trying to get from them, you know, the power of attorneys to represent them before any courts, and to help and assist and communicate with the U.S. government, for example, the Minister of Defense, and try to find a way and means or to follow up, you know, their destination, whether they will be released or they will be put on trial. Our aim is humanitarian. It is a voluntarily committee. We don't take money. We are NGO, and we only do it for sake of human rights.
And do you have a publication or a website, or how do people get in touch with the committee?
The committee could be, we have actually an Arabic website, which is called Guantanamo website. In English, I think they could contact through you, you know, my coordination. They could contact through my my email, which is, if I would say that.
Oh, yes, please, go ahead.
Okay, it is drnajeeb at qatar.net.qa. Again, Dr. DRAJEEB at QATAR Qatar.net.qa. This is my email. Anybody can send me and I will reply immediately. And everybody is welcome to know more and further on the detainees in our legal status or situation.
Okay, in about 1 minute, I'm going to be taking a station break. But in the meantime, I'd like to tell listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Najeeb or for Edward Spanas or for me, Michelle Steinberg, on the LaRouche Show, you can reach us by email right now. And the address is radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio, R-A-D-I-O, at LaRouchePub, LaRouchePub.com. And we'll be able to take your questions by email. If we can't get to them on the air, we will be, we can write back to you with the answers or forward them to Dr. Najeeb. You can reach our office at EIR anytime during the week when we're not on the air at 1-888-347-3258. The LaRouche Show is a weekly internet webcast. It is part of a whole series of publications and outreach that we have in the LaRouche movement, including our weekly magazine, Executive Intelligence Review, the biweekly newspaper in English, The New Federalist, and our EIR online publication, which is called Electronic Intelligence Weekly. Each of these publications is unique. We are not objective journalists. You might say that we have the story behind the story. Right now, if you get the upcoming issue of the EIR, you will see our proposed exit strategy for the Bush administration. They can exit from this war crisis, but it requires the exit of Richard Perle from the Defense Policy Board and Vice President Dick Cheney. If they exit, we have a fine exit strategy. Both Perle and Dick Cheney, as exposed in an upcoming issue of the EIR, are deeply involved in conflict of interest, possibly, corruption, possibly, profiteering from the war on terrorism, possibly. These are all charges that need to be investigated. This will be appearing in issue number 11 for 2003 of EIR. Call our toll-free telephone number 1-888-347-3258 for information on how to obtain this issue of EIR. Let's go back to the show, and Dr. Najeeb can be with us for the next 15 minutes, and we'll continue the interview, but I'd like to also introduce our panel. We have some student leaders on with us. We have Michelle Lerner from our Philadelphia office and Rihanna St. Classis from our West Coast office. Rihanna, are you in LA or Seattle this week?
I'm in Seattle.
Okay, welcome. And Michelle, are you with us?
Yeah.
Okay. Do either of you have a question at this time? Otherwise, we can continue and get back to you.
I had a really quick question, actually. I'm curious on if there's been any movement internationally other than this group of lawyers that has been forming regarding what's happening in the holding of people in Guantanamo.
Dr. Najeeb, do you know that?
Yes. Yeah, there are, in fact, many, for example, the Human Rights Watch in New York have done a lot of and good things, in fact, by corresponding to the government, sending letters and trying to raise a lot of questions. International Amnesty as well have done a tremendous and a good work, and they have submitted a memorandum to the Foreign Office here explaining, you know, the breach of international law by the U.S. over the detainees issue. And there are as well something called the Arab Human Rights Committee in Paris have done tremendous publication and communication as well, trying to explain and assist really in clarifying the difference between what is a terrorist, you know, act and what is, you know, in fact, people believe in religion and faith. We should not mix between who would really do some crime and to be, you know, linked to a ideology and a faith, which is very well practiced and very well, you know, in exercising the peace rather than the violent. Yes, there are many international groups, but the difference are these groups, in fact, more in the human rights activities. We are having a different character as we are really approaching practically as lawyers rather than as writing reports or communication or publication. We do on the actual act to defend.
Rihanna, did you have any questions at this time?
No, that's good. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Najib, are there any specific charges against any of the people in Guantanamo relating to September 11th or other alleged crimes at this point?
No, we have to distinguish between September 11th and between who being really arrested in Afghanistan. Who did September 11th? Were actually a group of people who were actually moved to the U.S. and carried out such a, you know, horrible act. The one who was in Guantanamo were actually either visiting Pakistan or Afghanistan, or having a short period of charity work, or even one of them was actually there to get married, and it's his second night of marriage. He, in Pakistan, was kidnapped early in the morning by some youngster in exchange of a few hundred dollars handed over to some joint force of American and Pakistani. That guy had nothing to do, just getting married. But unfortunately, at that time, anybody who would be known to have an Arabic accent or an Arabic face or whatever will be arrested on the presumption he might have some link with Al-Qaeda or, you know, other organization, which is false really image being made by the media. And these people are, most of them, or some of them, by the way, farmers, some of them drivers, some of them taxi drivers, some of them a bookshop, some of them workers, some of them, or we call them teachers, and not really as they're being classified. There is no charges against them until this moment.
Now, I've read that a number of the inmates at Guantanamo have tried to commit suicide. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yes. There were a few attempts. In fact, a few months ago, there was one of the doctors in Guantanamo Hospital, in an interview with BBC, the English Broadcasting, mentioned about 29 to 30 tried to commit suicide, and I have, you know, investigated myself that statement and find out it was not true. The doctor was referring to people were injured in the ex-camp, and their cause of injury is really frustration or getting very tired because of the interrogation, and they come because they had not enough sleep. So, like, for example, he hit his head to the bar and he get injured, you know, in the head or cry or, you know, because of frustration. Then he gets some injury I'm taken to the hospital, and they classified as committed suicide. After that, there were a release of a statement from the defense, I think, saying, oh, no, no, it's only 3 people and not 29. Then recently, just last month, one of my clients, that serious, he tried to commit suicide, and he has a brain hemorrhage at the moment in Guantanamo Hospital. This guy is not living. I mean, he's almost dying, and we requested that he should go home and die between his family. He's not being charged yet, but we don't know what happened. Committing suicide by Muslims is a crime itself. But it shows you how far these people, you know, feeling really inside their hearts that they are innocent and being kept over 1 year or 4 months isolated in a small cell and getting really frustrated, you know, getting letters and sending letters, that's normal, through the Red Cross, and they explain, you know, we are innocent. They have wives, they have mother, father, they have brothers, so just like any normal person. If you keep anybody normal for a few days, then he gets crazy. So you would expect anything could happen to them.
They've actually done kind of experiments with this on how to break people or drive them crazy. Ed, I have a question for you. What effect would our campaign in exposing and getting Ashcroft out, would that have an effect on this horrendous situation that Dr. Najib is describing?
Sure, because I mean, what's happening at Guantanamo is just really an extreme case, a matter of degree, of what's happening inside the United States itself. Even though the Guantanamo prisoners, as Dr. Najib has said, this falls under the military or under the Department of Defense, the actual sort of crafting of this policy was done by Ashcroft. Ashcroft is operating as part of a team within the administration. And this is actually what Lyndon LaRouche warned about, if you remember, back at the time of the confirmation fight about Ashcroft. That LaRouche warned that under crisis conditions, that it's not just Ashcroft's role as Attorney General, but Ashcroft's role as a crisis management team. And that's exactly what's happened. The way that he's worked with the Pentagon, with Rumsfeld on this stuff, the Homeland Security Department, he is sort of, Ashcroft is the president's chief legal advisor. But in this case, I mean, legal is hardly the word for it.
He's an illegal advisor.
He's the chief advisor for tearing up the Constitution. So knocking Ashcroft out would make a big difference, because for a country that, and I'm sure Dr. Najib could tell us a lot about this, for years has preached to other countries about the rule of law, about human rights, how you must follow the law, you must follow procedures. Yeah. And since September 11th, Ashcroft has been in the forefront of just throwing all of this out the window. And they've done a lot of the same thing for detainees and the dragnets here, even for American citizens, as we've seen in the case of Padilla and Hamdi, and what's happening in Guantanamo, where they're saying they have no rights whatsoever. So it really is, it's all the same package. And Ashcroft is the guy who's right in the middle of it. And if we can get rid of him, if he would exit along with Wolfowitz and Pearl, we need an exit strategy out of this police state horror that he's creating right now.
Okay, we have about 10 more minutes before I go to our youth panel and get an update on the organizing that they have been doing in Washington and on the West Coast. But I already have an email from our international LaRouche youth movement in France, in Rennes. They're listening to this webcast right now. They sent in a question, one for Ed, one for Dr. Najib. First, from Kevin DePlanc of the LaRouche Youth Movement, to Ed. If there's no Iraq war, what will the chicken hawks become? Maybe they won't survive our exposing them. And then a follow-up question for Dr. Najib from Julien Lemaitre. A similar question. What is the role of the chicken hawks, what we also call the neoconservative war party? What is the role of the chicken hawks in the treatment of the Guantanamo detainees? Ed, you want to start off?
If there's no war, the chicken hawks are gone. The chicken hawks will exit very soon after it's, if it becomes clear that the war is not there, because these guys have really built their whole careers in the past 10, 12 years, have devoted themselves very single-mindedly to going after Iraq, going after Saddam Hussein as part of an overall plan to redraw the map of the Middle East and to make the United States an imperial power, to have the United States follow in the tracks of the British Empire or the Venetian Empire or the Roman Empire. And if the war is stopped, which we certainly are fighting to see that it is, the whole edifice which these guys have constructed is going to start to crumble. The lies that they have used to try and justify this war, the phony intelligence that they have fed into Secretary of State Powell and to the president, I mean, the whole thing is a lying, falsified, farcical construction that they've used to try and drag this country into this war and into this clash of civilizations. And I think people will begin to see through that, and that will crumble quickly.
Well, as we've said, this war isn't about Iraq to begin with.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I mean, Iraq is simply the pretext. And that's why if you go back, as we've done, and look at the clean break, go back to the defense policy guidance of Cheney, Wolfowitz, Lewis Libby from 1991, 1992, it was never about Iraq. But Iraq is, they talk about Iraq publicly incessantly, but the real plan behind this thing is really to recreate a new Roman Empire as an American empire with no challengers. Any challenger will be crushed with nuclear weapons if necessary.
Dr. Najib, do you want to hear the question again? Or?
Yeah, no, I could answer it. Well, I think the role is very well reflected on how you detained, you know, 43 nationalities in an island and isolated in an X-ray camp, which were like a cages, you know, like, I mean, the animals much better than where they were, in fact. It's reflected on how they've been detained without a legal explanation, how they were treated, how they were neglected, actually, the right of, you know, meeting with the lawyers, neglecting the right for, you know, calling their families, neglecting the right of being a human. And in early, as Mr. Spencer said, in early, prior to September, we were lectured very well by the U.S. governments in our countries that human rights should prevail. You should not strip anybody's, you know, passport or nationality. People should not be detained more than 24 hours or 48 hours without a legal explanation or an access to a lawyer. And you get all these nice wordings and nice advice we were giving. Now, to my surprise, in fact, after September, I've seen all this being abolished from the legal system in the U.S. That's how you see how they've been influenced, really, the legal system.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Najib. This, I believe, is your second trip, at least, to the United States.
Yes.
In connection with the Guantanamo detainees.
Yes.
Have you gotten any meetings or any response from anyone in the United States government? I mean, you're here representing these prisoners. You're representing their families. Yes. You're coming to the capital of a country which is supposed to be the champion of human rights. Has anybody in the government been willing to talk to you about these things?
Well, according to our normal correspondence, I have met the Ministry of Defense people, and they assured me that there will be some people will be released, being found not really guilty of anything and innocent after a long time, and some will be put in a trial. I have, as you know, I have sent 422 letters to 422 MPs and congressmen. I have sent actually a letter to the Committee for International Committee for International Relations, an email. I spoke to them, requesting that if we could be given a chance to speak on the Congress committees or the Senate. No reply. I sent to Elizabeth Cheney in the Foreign Office an email. I spoke to her office, saying, you know, you have to hear us. We have to explain. They said send an email, and no reply. I don't know. Not much of correspondence. I think the feelings of being superpower could neglect anybody, not only me.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. That last statement was from Dr. Najib bin Mohammed al-Nawimi, who is the creator of the Committee for the Defense of the Detainees and POWs in Guantanamo. Dr. Najib is the former Justice Minister of Qatar. He is an international political figure, and he has made his second trip to the United States, fighting for the basic human rights under international law for these detainees. The United States is making history with this treatment of international detainees. Unfortunately, it is a history that we don't want to remember with pride, and we have to change. Dr. Najib, we're going to, we have a few more minutes. Tell us what you're going to be doing next after this appeal and your international activity. And I might ask, what was your impression in terms of the LaRouche movement and dialogue with Mr. LaRouche while you were here?
Well, I had really a lunch last Saturday and a meeting with Mr. LaRouche. I think he has his own way of destination in the changing for the good, and I think he has clear idea how he would like handle such an administration if he would be winning the presidency. And I think the movement is really a clear-cut if we say have a good faith. I mean, you can see in your movement that you're saying the truth and you're dealing with the facts and you're basing your movement in humanitarian and social activities. And I love you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We'd like to have you back and keep in touch with everything that you're doing. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, March 15th, 2003. We have been discussing the fight we're going to launch or relaunch this week on a call by Lyndon LaRouche to fire John Ashcroft. Replace him, get the Constitution back in the United States, and continue with this effort to stop the war in Iraq. One of the most important aspects of this has been the activity this last week of the LaRouche International Youth Movement. We have Rihanna from Seattle and Michelle from Philadelphia on today. Michelle this week on Tuesday was part of a very intense, combative political force down in Washington, D.C., where they had an agenda, the Lyndon LaRouche campaign. Michelle, tell our listeners what the youth movement was doing this week.
Well, actually, over the past 2 weeks, we've been going to Congress and discussing with the members of the Congressional Black Caucus and also the staff in their offices, their aides, and so forth, about a set of debates that they're actually going to be sponsoring for presidential candidates. And we were demanding that they include Lyndon LaRouche in all of these debates. And I know that since we started doing this, there actually was a discussion that started over this question, whether or not Lyndon LaRouche should be included as a Democrat to take part in the debates that they're going to be sponsoring. And I know the chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus did not respond during the first few days. I'm not sure if he has responded yet. I know since that Tuesday, the first Tuesday that we went, not this past one, but the one before that, the next day after that is when they had their meeting and this discussion started. He did not respond then. And then when we came back the following Tuesday, which was this past Tuesday, we had the leaflet, the statement that Lyndon LaRouche put out on March 8th on what Secretary Powell did not say. We woke up early, made sure we got a whole bunch of these out in the city of Washington, D.C., and at the various subway stops. Then we had a sort of pseudo rally at one of the subway stations right near the congressional buildings. And after that, we all of us from the East Coast youth movement that were present went to the chairman's office and tried to speak with someone. After a couple of minutes, they were kind of giving us a runaround, didn't want to hear from us, or didn't, you know, what they normally do.
How many of you were there involved in these activities?
I think between 40 and 50 on that day.
Okay.
We actually filled up the entire office. There was barely any room to breathe in there, especially with the heat we were creating.
The political heat.
Yeah, exactly. So after some time, the chief of staff came out. We went out into the hallway, and we were discussing with the chief of staff why they should actually include Lyndon LaRouche, and saying that it's not just a matter of his personal rights, and even if it were, we would still fight for them, but it's a matter of the rights of the citizenry to actually be allowed to hear what everybody has to say regarding the crisis that we're in right now. And they should not be disenfranchising their citizens, their constituents, by not allowing Mr. LaRouche to take part in the debate. In other words, that the Democratic Party should not be a private club, nor should any other of the political parties that are representing the people. And he had an interesting response. He was a little bit surprised to see us. I don't think they've had a lot of students in that office coming in and asking something like that. I think it was quite a different experience. He was a little bit jumpy and... you know, it was an interesting meeting, but, you know, as soon as we left, he was still thinking about us, and that's the point. We need to really shake these people up, give them what they're not expecting, and show them how serious we are about actually taking up this fight. So I think since then, after that, we actually broke into groups and went to all of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus and discuss the same ideas, that they should be including LaRouche in the debates that they're holding. And we also got out these leaflets to every office. So we'll have to see how things shape up for next week. But it was a very strategic intervention that we did. And afterward, we went back to the subways and got out more of these leaflets. So it was a really good intervention.
Great. This was nationwide. And Rihanna, if you're there, can you give us a picture of the West Coast side of this mobilization on the Powell leaflet and also Lyndon LaRouche's campaign?
Sure. Of course, the main thing that's happening is the contingent from California invading the California State Democratic Convention this weekend. They already had some interesting activity yesterday. We just got a very brief kind of anecdotal report, but it seems like things are pretty fun there. And they're actually getting some very interesting responses, as well as freaking out a lot of the Democratic hacks who weren't expecting to have such an active group of young people forcing the issue on reality. And of course, we've been getting a lot of the leaflets out and mobilizing in Seattle as well, and had a very interesting rally down at the state capitol, which is a part of something a whole group of things we're going to be doing over the next couple of weeks. We're going to be going to the Oregon State Legislature as well. And what's enjoyable about this is that we've been doing this for the whole legislative session, and we increase in numbers every time. We went in there with about 8 or 9 people in the beginning of the session, and this last time I think we were about 15. So it's kind of fun to give them a sense of what we're doing. And of course, there's from what I understand, I think there's about 75 to 80 young people in this California State Democratic Convention, which certainly rivals the number of other youth who are present, and we're the only organized force there. And they went in yesterday, I think, was primarily various kind of caucus meetings, and they actually got some very interesting responses from some people in the audience. Particularly the one I was thinking of was, a panel or a caucus for children, and it was being dominated by these 60-year-olds, and they didn't want to let any of our people speak, and a couple stood up and said, you know, look, this is what you're talking about is our future. You're talking about the future of youth, and if we don't address this crisis situation immediately, then this is a moot point. We might as well not be having this discussion. And so then they decide, well, it's okay for you to talk about and ask questions as long as you don't mention the name of Lyndon LaRouche. And so then another one of our organizers stood up and said, this is totally absurd. You know, you say you want to, you know, this is supposed to be a free, you know, political discussion, and you don't, and you're trying to block us from being able to talk about what we want to talk about as youth. And, you know, we want to talk about the means of averting this crisis, and we want to talk about what we can actually do for the economy. And what's interesting is, of course, we've had a lot of effect in California. There's the youth movement has had a presence there for a good three and a half years now. And they're seeing some of that being reflected in discussions with labor and various other groups at this convention who are talking about infrastructure projects. They're talking about 30-year-long projects. They're talking about rail. They're talking about high-speed magnetic levitated trains. They wouldn't, I don't think, be talking about this in anywhere near the kind of way that they are had it not been for what we're doing. Of course, what they're talking about is completely impossible to accomplish in the paradigm that they're in which everything is either, you know, raising taxes or cutting the budget. I mean, it's totally, it's impossible for them. They're dreaming as far as what they're talking about. But the fact that these issues are out there, and there was also a very interesting thing occurred when the aide for the governor spoke, and we intervened on him as well, and the issue being LaRouche being brought into the California State Legislature, and so he addressed that, and then he talked for a while, and then at the end he said, okay, so I guess the two things that you want me to take to the governor are, first, this local issue that I guess some other group of people had brought up, and then he said, and bringing Lyndon LaRouche into the legislature.
Oh, boy. Well, with that, we are almost out of time, and on that note, this has been the LaRouche Show for March 15th, 2003, defending the Constitution, getting the LaRouche leadership in this country on track before it's too late. Call us at 1-888-347-3258 for more information.